The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. And this is the day after Christmas. It's a time for family. And sometimes for loneliness, it's a time for celebration and sometimes for regrets. I want to do what I can today with my wonderful guest, my marvelous guest, to make it a time for growing and looking forward to the new year, to enjoying life, to finding new principles of hope, and for just making this your best year. And I don't mean that in some superficial fashion. I really believe that we can plan our lives. Now, we have to be given a certain amount. We have to be given life, and life has to be sustained. And, of course, there's health, good fortune, other things that play a role. But with what we're given, it's our attitudes toward our lives that's going to make, by far and away, the biggest difference in how we do. My guest today is my friend, Dr. Gerald Porter, Jerry, and he has a really distinguished career in the field of counseling and mental health, management and education, and he's just a genuinely real good person, a very good person to have on the day after Christmas. He's currently Vice President for Academic Affairs at the School of Professional Psychology at the Forest Institute in Springfield, Missouri. In his very distinguished career, he's been Dean of the School of Natural Arts and Sciences at Bastyr University. He's been chair of the Department of Counseling and Psychological Services at SUNY Oswego, where I first met him and got to know him and his wife. And before that, he was dean of the School of Education at SUNY Cortland. And he's also been in the state government in a variety of policy positions in government, education, corrections, economic development. His research interests are broad, including race and gender, psychiatry, psychiatric disorders. The day after Christmas, although this show is pre-recorded, the day after Christmas, I welcome Jerry Porter to my show. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I'm good. I'm already in the spirit of the season, and I couldn't think of a better person to have on for an optimistic and yet sober look at what it means to be looking at the celebrations of this time of year for all the various religions, as well as the Judeo-Christian traditions and religions. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. And thank you, by the way, for that very generous introduction. That was very kind. So, yes, I'm delighted to be here. And, you know, I think that this is a really special time to reflect on mental health issues and personal growth issues, and you know, with the new year so imminent, I think it's really an optimal time to kind of think about how do you want to begin to prepare for, you know, the next step in your journey.
Well, I like that idea of the next step in your journey, because I think it's a lot more than just hokey to view life as a journey. I mean, it is. We are moving. We're moving through time and space. Mm-hmm. And when you get to be my age, it seems like you're moving really fast. And before you know it, another year is gone. And it's so important to be approaching each year with a very good attitude, with good principles, with forethought. And I know you're on that same page with me. Mm-hmm. Where would you like to begin, Jerry? What are you thinking about right at this time in terms of the coming year?
Well, you know, there is so much that's really wonderful and positive about the holidays and this time of year. But, you know, for many people, this is a very challenging period. And, you know, they really grapple with depression and with feelings of anxiety about having to cope with families that have many unresolved issues. And so, you know, I think that one of the more interesting things to take a look at is the whole question of emotional management. You know, Lincoln once said, "I reckon folks are just about as happy as they want to be." And, you know, at first glance, that might seem like almost a blaming statement, that if you're depression, it's your own fault. But I think it's really a recognition that with the right kind of awareness of ourselves, that over a sustained period of time, we can really manage our emotional states. Not so readily from moment to moment, perhaps, but quite a bit from over the long term. And, well, actually, I'll correct that. And from moment to moment as well, although there are different strategies involved. So, you know, from my point of view, this idea of emotional habit formation is something that might be interesting for us to explore just a little bit.
Well, define that, what you mean by emotional habit formation, and what you do with that.
Sure. Well, let's take like depression, an emotion like or an affective state like depression. And, you know, the contemporary, the prevailing view is that depression is caused by basically physiological states. And that those can be corrected through medication. And often the assumption, as you know, better than most, of the psychiatric profession is that it's wholly a physiological event and has very little to do in any meaningful or substantial way with the circumstances in a person's life, or for that matter, with how they manage their emotions over a period of time. And I would argue that depression, I think, is an excellent example of an affective state that arises because people have habitually chosen, perhaps unconsciously and unwittingly, negative emotional responses. Perhaps they learned from other family members as children, but nevertheless developed a pattern which has brought them down a road where they're now in a very destructive, problematic, painful, debilitating emotional state that, with the right kind of action, probably a long time ago, could have been avoided.
Yeah, let's look at some of those attitudes that people bring in and see if I understand what you're talking about. I view it, I tend to think of them, and I think it's the same thing, as self-defeating patterns of life. Mm-hmm. Where you have ideas and attitudes that really undermine your chances of success. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, very much so. So it's, on the one hand, there are self-defeating behavioral patterns that people engage in, but emotionally and psychologically there are self-defeating thought patterns and emotional patterns that people engage in as well. And I think you know, you have things like rational emotive therapy or whatever, where there's a greater awareness of the cognition that might be associated with, you know, debilitating emotional states and problematic psychiatric conditions on the far end. But I think there's less awareness of those emotional states. So So, for example, a lot of folks think if I get into a problematic situation, it's okay for me to feel sorry for myself. It's okay for me, what I would say, indulge in all the negative emotions that arise from distressing or problematic situations that we will inevitably face in our lives. And that's just a big mistake. We have to learn to not go down certain routes, even though there's a certain gratification that comes with allowing oneself to indulge in a fit of anger or in a fit of, oh, poor me, I've been mistreated and abused, or to indulge in feelings of inadequacy. Now, I say indulge because there is a certain point where that can be managed. There's a certain point when you've been so habitually responding that way that it becomes functionally unlikely and improbable that a person is going to be able to deal with that in the immediate context.
It's like you need to learn to catch yourself the minute you're saying something that is sure to perpetuate or self-fulfill a bad outcome, like poor me, I just get a raw deal all the time, or why did this have to happen to me, or people are really just not going to let me get what I want out of life, or nobody gets what they want out of life, or women don't understand men, or men don't understand women. Or we're talking about emotions that thoughts. I'm doing thoughts right now, but under those are these emotions you're talking about of helplessness and self-pitying, which are deadly for us. Once we're into feeling sorry for ourselves, all is lost until we can turn that around.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is, there's something kind of, there's a subtle kind of pleasure and gratification that one gets when you kind of wallow in the negative emotional state. And, you know, it's a curious thing. I think that most therapists will certainly have had an opportunity to observe it in their clients and, as well as in themselves. You know, that kind of pleasure that you get when you go down that, say, self-piteous route. And that's something that's really treacherous. We need to really teach children. You know, this is not the way to respond. This is not productive. And all of this is not I certainly recognize and appreciate that lots of folks grow up in really, really problematic and destructive family situations. And part of that, growing up in a difficult or problematic family situation, is as a child, you learn these problematic emotional responses. And so it certainly is true that lots of folks in our society, in our culture, really don't know any better because they've never had a chance to receive a proper, let's call it, emotional education.
I think that's right. And yet also, you occasionally see people who have been through some of the most horrendous abuse as children, and they get a different idea for whatever reason as kids, and often I can't tell why, but they decide, I'm going to be different than my mother, my father, my brother, my sister. I'm not going to be like this. I'm not going to hurt other people. I'm not going to be acting helpless all the time. I'm going to model my life on something better. And I've seen people model themselves on sports heroes or musical heroes. And as children decide that they're going to be in charge of their lives, and they still have all that pain and suffering, but they have a leg up when it comes to outgrowing it because they've gotten the idea somehow for themselves or from some source unknown that they can take charge of their lives. They don't have to be a victim in their lives.
Yes, yes, and that's really one of the wonderful things that that happen, and it's proof that it really isn't life circumstances by themselves, that that the individual is a creative, productive, I mean, there's something that people really have in themselves that can make a difference, and that special uniqueness of the person is what we want to nurture and cultivate. I would agree with that. It's always a delight to see that when a person just transcends what seems to be almost insurmountable life circumstances.
You know, my mother-in-law, Jean, Ginger's mom, is just a marvelous example of that. I have watched her, you know, go through losing her husband, and I've watched her go through then a couple of serious illnesses. And throughout that whole period of time, she's responded to each new challenge by, if anything, becoming more loving, more caring to the people around her, including me and her daughter, Ginger, and to the people in her community. So even faced with grave challenges. And another thing I've seen, Jerry, which is so interesting to me, is I've seen people both in my family and personal life and in my practice who have come to face the most difficult imaginable challenges, like knowledge that they're going to be dying in a couple of years, or cancer that was unpredictable but was serious. And I've seen people take those challenges and live the best they've ever lived before in terms of really caring about people. I know in my practice I've seen a couple of my patients over the years who were very angry and very hostile and just were so afraid of being vulnerable and loving. And they developed cancer. They got diagnoses of cancer. And they came in not caved in. But for whatever reason, they came back into the therapy saying, I don't want to be that anymore. I only have a few years left. Mm-hmm. And I've seen them become more loving than most folks when weeks earlier they've been bitter and angry and giving their spouses hard times. And I've also seen it in chronic illness, where when a person realizes they're going to be nearing the end in a few years, where instead of caving in helplessly to death and complaining more and being angry or being more frustrated, they've turned their lives around and have spread a lot of joy and a lot of love in their last years. So even if the challenge is some of the scariest ones, like cancer or death, people have the opportunity to seize on them to decide, I'm going to be different. So my invitation to myself and to all of us is, why not do it now?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they say there's no time like the present, and I think this is a great example. You know, just to pick up on what you said, you know, I think what I would call the deathbed perspective is a great way to really get your values aligned. Because if you really think about, if I were on my deathbed, would this really matter? Would this be something that would make a difference? Would this be something that I would care about? And if the answer is no, I think that's a very strong indication that maybe this isn't so important, and maybe this isn't the best investment of our energy. You know, the other thought that I have too about this point that you've raised is the notion that suffering is inescapable and inevitable in life, and you know, so much of the difficulty and problem that people have is in trying to completely escape from and not deal with suffering. And I think that the right perspective to have it is not to have a masochistic embrace of suffering, but rather to recognize that it's an opportunity for cultivating all of those really wonderful qualities that we have, like love and courage and compassion and caring for others. You know, it's an opportunity, and so, and I think so much of the difficulty that people run into, especially psychologically or emotionally, are their attempts to escape from, deny the inevitability of suffering. You know, dissociative responses are so much, an escape, but because people haven't learned how to. Haven't had the opportunity to really process some of these experiences. So,
yeah, I think that what we call mania or a manic episode is very much that kind of thing. It's an escape from depression. So we go from I'm helpless and hopeless and life is dreadful and I can't do anything about it and I might as well die or kill myself. And I don't say that lightly. I mean that I understand the depth of that pain to, oh no, I'm fabulous. I've got great plans. I'm actually president of the United States. I've actually already gotten my medical degree. I'm already investing in fabulous investments. I'm going to live forever. I found the secret to life. So both, in a way, depression and mania are escapes from the real world where we actually always have the opportunity to do something worth doing. And it often involves doing something loving and caring and productive for other human beings as well as for ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the interesting thing is to make that leap where the focus is on someone else and helping and assisting other people rather than, you know, a focus on self and our pain and suffering. That requires a kind of inner separation or a kind of inner space where there's some distance between our reaction and how we decide to respond to those situations. So that, you know, I think that one of the most interesting things is that we don't have the power to choose unless we can have some what I would call non-identification with our emotions, with our thoughts, even with our physical reactions and responses. We need to be able to step back and look at that and then decide, what does that mean? What should I do about it with an understanding of this context in which I'm presently embedded? And again, this is one of those things that we ought to be teaching kids so that by the time they grow up, they're really skilled at doing this. And, you know, some people are intuitive and they kind of figure this out. Some people have the good fortune of having parents or experiences that do teach them this. But for the most part, it's a school of hard knocks for people in developing these kinds of what we're calling emotional management skills, self-understanding. And that's a shame because there's so much possibility in being able to really approach our life on a positive footing, which of course we're hoping everybody will do with the new year.
Yes, and I think everybody has to do it. I think it may have been Eric Fromm, who's the existential psychologist, who said every generation has to learn about love for itself. Not love for self, but has to learn about love. That you may be taught it by your parents, but by golly, there's going to come a time and you got to learn it for yourself. What it really means to love with all your heart and all your soul, and to do it through thick and thin and through your pain and through your suffering. And that's what, it's that kind of devotion to the coming year, that determination that will really enormously pay off for people. And I like very much what you're saying about the separation from our negative emotions. One of the things I encourage people to do, for example, if I'm working with a couple, or that I encourage in myself, is to look at their emotion and instead of expressing it, to ask, is this going to advance my relationship? Is telling my husband or my wife, I'm really angry, or telling them what's the matter with them, or as they say in AA, taking somebody's inventory, their moral inventory for them, is that going to advance the relationship? So self-expression in terms of expressing feelings of helplessness, outrage, anger, jealousy, meanness, and so on, that's that kind of spontaneous expression is not the secret to life. It's not spontaneous expression. It's actually having that distance you're talking about where you can then self-evaluate as you go along and say, do I want to just use that feeling as a signal I'm hurt and not say a word like that and then instead address my relationship in a more positive way to try to move it along, to try to make it more loving? And that's about the only way we know what we can get out of life and out of other people, and what we're gonna receive from other people is by each time not acting on the dangerous, destructive impulses and feelings, but bringing in the ideals of an ethical and a loving approach. I think it's extremely important.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. There's never any legitimate reason to indulge in a negative emotion. It's always destructive. And I think that you're right, that the what really gives us the opportunity for freedom, freedom, I think, in the most meaningful sense of the word, is that ability to not be identified with those negative emotions, but to be able to step back and, as you say, make a choice. What is going to advance this relationship? What's really going to be the best step that I can take? One of the, I think, something that's very closely related to this is several things. One is that awareness of the internal dialogue. That monologue, dialogue, whatever you want to call it, kind of running in the background, continually commenting, often in a very negative way, about the immediate experience that the person has. And I think what's potentially problematic about identifying with that internal dialogue is that the attention of the person is drawn away from them really being fully present in the here and now, is drawn away from having, say, what I would call, say, full body awareness, which is the only way you're really going to be aware of your affective and emotional states, is to sense immediately in this present moment, how am I responding? Our bodies are this incredibly sensitive barometer to what's happening. But if our attention is directed away from the body, we're losing some of the most important data that we have. Now, again, it has to be understood and contextualized. Physiological arousal needs to have some kind of cognitive interpretation of what that means in that context in which we find ourselves in. But nevertheless, it's essential and important data.
Reading our emotions, not necessarily acting on them. And I think people can be more aware, as you're describing it, more aware of their body and their feelings if they know they're not going to act on them. Otherwise, yeah. You get scared. You're scared you're going to act on your anger. You're scared you're going to act on your sexual feelings inappropriately or out of context. So if you know that there's a difference between having feelings, knowing what they are, and expressing them, and in particular dumping them on another person, you can sit back and know you're angry, know you're hurt, know you're scared, and not respond, and then think to yourself, how am I going to respond in a way that actually helps our situation, helps what's going on, makes things better, moves us along, meets my ideals?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So, we're going to take a break in about 2 minutes or so, and two of the subjects I'd like to pick up on after the break is the idea first of gratitude, because one of the things that's the opposite of feeling helpless, feeling bitter, feeling resentful, feeling you got cheated or whatever else, is gratitude, being grateful for what you got, being grateful for the few last years of your life where you can be a more loving person, grateful that you're alive even though you're ill, grateful that you have the ability to reach out with love even though right now you're lonely, grateful for the sunshine and grateful for the clouds too, grateful for nature, which is always there for us to reach out to, grateful for God if you believe in God, grateful for God. So gratitude is really, really important. And the other thing I'd like to talk about when we get back is your last resort, because a real key to me in facing the new year and in having a wonderful life is, where are you going to turn when you're the most upset or the most distressed, most in need? Are you going to turn to anger, to alcohol, to television, to food, to psychiatric meds? Or are you going to find something bigger better and more wonderful to turn to? What's your last resort? I'd like folks to think about that and to think about gratitude. And Jerry, any quick thoughts on that? And then we'll go to a break.
Yeah, well, you know, the last resort, I think, is a very important idea, because I think every individual has to identify what's the tendency, the maladaptive tendency, which you are most prone to. That's one of the best defenses against these kinds of problematic situations that we've been talking about. So
your worst identify your worst resort. I've never thought of it that way. And your best last resort.
And your best as well. But I think, you know, some people respond with escape. Some people, you know, respond with aggression. Some people respond with withdrawal. You know, they're different patterns.
And, yes. Well, good. Let's bring on that My Marvelous Vangelis music and go to break and come back to ideas.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And I'm back with my friend Jerry Porter. Jerry is a psychologist, a PhD, and a good friend. He's currently the Vice President of Academic Affairs, the School of Professional Psychology at Forest Institute in Springfield, Missouri. One idea that you embellished on that is very important is this whole notion of what's your last resort? And for many people, the last resort is really, really bad. And for many people, it's really, really good. Jerry, you want to pick up on that, please?
Yeah. Well, actually, to pick up on two themes that you raised, I'd like to express some gratitude, because I realized that when you first started talking about last resort, you were really framing it in a positive way, where you're saying, you know, where would you turn to for strength and encouragement and so on? And I regret to say that as a mental health worker, practitioner, often my focus is on the negative, you know, escape, withdrawal, aggression, you know, whatever. So, you know, I think that you know, one of the really important things that we can do is begin to start framing these things as much as possible in a constructive and positive, empowering light. So, you know, that said, you know, last resort, I think, is a very useful mechanism for thinking about how you want to approach the future, because it really begins to sort things out. It helps you determine what's meaningful and important in your life, what's less important, what's problematic, maybe what is undermining our realizing what we want and what's meaningful for us. So,
I think one of the important things about this season is that many people find in God their last resort. And if you have an idea of a loving God, then you're in a very good position to be able to say, all right, I have a loving relationship. I have a loving relationship with God. I am loved by God. And I can spread that. I can give that to others and share it with others. Now, for many other folks, they have a more humanistic or secular feeling. I believe they need to find within themselves a concept, and within other human beings a concept, that love binds us together, and that we can seek love. We can seek love with others when we feel we're down and out, and that can be our last resort. I don't think an abstract sense of, I am a solitary person and I am my last resort, I don't think that tends to work very well for us. I think we're too social for that. What's your thoughts, Jerry?
Well, I would agree that we are too social for that. I think that there are real mysteries that we confront in life, and I am really persuaded that none of the prevailing worldviews, either religious or secular, really capture everything that, in some sense, is really fundamental in this mystery of life. But one of the things that my experience has persuaded me is true is that, in some sense, we as human beings really are all one. We really are a family, in some sense. And there's some deep and profound underlying connection that we as human beings share with one another, no matter how seemingly from outward things, culture, race, gender, all of that, that in some sense we really are one. And that to me is in some sense a basis for why it's anything that really denies our interconnectedness, our relationship with one another in this most fundamental way, ultimately is destructive both to the individual and also to the larger society.
I think that's true, and I think we can make it really positive in the sense of as long as we can feel one with our own human nature, the human nature of others, as long as we can see the common source that we all come from, whether it's evolution, God, or human nature, as long as we can feel at one with nature, feel a part of it, feel inspired by it, we're on the right track.
I completely agree. I think it's automatically a sign of pathology when people begin to feel alienated and disconnected, because that's telling you, in some sense, where you need to be plugged in, you're not.
Yes.
And so where I think something like gratitude really comes in is that's one of the ways we get plugged in, is that when I begin to recognize that, what's most real about this situation I'm in, is I'm very fortunate. No matter how difficult my situation is, I'm alive. There's this incredible and stupendous miracle of me actually, what would seem to be against the incredible odds of random chance, I am alive, and I have this life, and it presents me with an opportunity for all the things that we talked about earlier, love and meaning and whatever. And if that gratitude can get translated into really caring and compassionate action on behalf of others, I think that almost the worst situation can be turned around. There is so much to be grateful for, and gratitude, interestingly enough, is, I think, one of the ways to truly connect even more deeply and profoundly with life. And another thing closely related to forgiveness is instead of carrying around that burden of, they done me wrong, to really find forgiveness of other people. If nothing else, out of enlightened self-interest, because how much it weighs you down and absorbs your energy and keeps you from being able to really experience an emotional openness that's going to enable you to access pleasure is not something I think is widely appreciated. But it's, again, one of these sort of truths that that people ought to know.
I'm really with you on this. I mean, we're kind of summarizing some of the most important ideas for having a good life, that our emotions are important signals, but they're not the truth. We don't act on anger, don't necessarily act on sex, don't necessarily act on self-hate. They're signals that we're injured, and that we then have to take that deep breath and act on reason, ethics, and love. And that as we're acting on reason and love, very important aspects of that are to feel grateful for what we have, to feel forgiving toward others, and that if we actually can begin to work on this inside ourselves and the way we relate to others, we begin to guarantee we're going to get the most out of whatever we're given. We can't be sure what we're going to be given, but we'll make the most out of what we're going to be given, and we can approach the new year with a lot of confidence in that way. I'd like to talk a little more now about that last resort idea, because I think it's so critical, because the other side and an aspect of this is when we're facing the new year or new difficulties or new problems, and we feel we're at our wit's end or rock bottom or just fed up or whatever other way we express, that's it, I've had enough. Are we going to have a last resort that really empowers us and starts the process of reaching back to others, or are we going to have a last resort that leads downhill? Now, psychiatric drugs, for me, are not a good last resort. I think that they inhibit the function of the brain. They inhibit spirituality, by which I mean everything we're talking about today. They inhibit everything we're looking forward to welcoming the new year with, because they take the edge off of the frontal lobes. They take the edge off our highest centers of our brain, as well as a few other centers, and maybe all the centers, depending on the dose and the drug. And that the more we can welcome our painful emotions and then be guided by our more positive emotions, the better off we're going to be. That our last resort needs to be in this realm of God as we know God, or humanity and human nature and as we know it. It has to be in something more positive. For me, I keep coming back to love, that having a joyful awareness of other human beings and responding to that, and of animals, our pets, and nature, that's my last resort. My last resort is to come back to myself as a source of love, and the knowledge that there's some sort of loving force in the universe, I think is so critical, the good last resort rather than the negative last resort.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the problem, the challenge for many folks is that, just take love. I think one of the great misunderstandings about love is that love is an emotional state. And I think that it would be more accurate to describe love as a condition. Love is a condition that one is, in some sense, embedded within. It's not a state, although one may subjectively experience it sometimes as a state. And I think we need to really not really look for the transitoriness of emotional states that arise within us as that ground that you've been referring to, that you turn to as a last resort. And you have to find that place in yourself. It's there in all of us, but it takes a certain degree of a cultivation of self-awareness, sensitivity, and responsiveness to our own interior spaces, to be able to find and connect with that.
I'm there 100% with you. I really want folks to be thinking about the coming year, that they have within themselves a core that has the capacity for love. You wouldn't be walking and talking if you didn't have that. You wouldn't be alive if you didn't have that. So that within all of us is the ability to allow ourselves to experience joy and happiness about existence, about what comes our way, the people, the animals, nature, the activities, creativity, that we have it within ourselves and that we can touch other human beings. We can touch nature. And I've wondered, why do I love gardening and lugging rocks around? I think it's because I'm participating in nature and helping bring out some creativity in some little corner of nature that I'm affecting. I know when I do therapy, I'm never sad. I'm never self-preoccupied. I'm never narcissistic. When I'm doing therapy, I know what my job is. My job is to care about that other human being in a way that's really going to be helpful to them so that their time with me is well spent and they leave feeling that life is better than I actually imagined. Well, if you bring that to your relationships, that sense that you have within yourself the capacity to care about others in that way and about other aspects of life, your work, artistic creation, obviously friendships and family and nature, that you're going to have a better year than you ever imagined possible, and that new things will happen, new people will come to you and meet you on that same level. Nature will reach out to you and meet you on that same level. And indeed, you can have the best year of your life, even if it's the toughest year of your life.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think the emotional state, the emotional condition, environment that we create around ourselves actually shapes what becomes possible for us in the future. Is that if you're in a sort of self-destructive, negative emotional pattern, people respond to you differently, and the opportunities and experiences that become accessible to you are very different than those if you're on a constructive, positive, life-affirming kind of emotional pathway. And another thing in what you said that I find myself really resonating with is there's a positive kind of abandonment. You know, that what I might call egoic self persona, whatever you want to call it, which is sort of obsessed with poor me and all the negative states and so on. That's something that is a great idea to shed, and creative activity, like you described, working in the garden, engaged in work activities that are meaningful and important to you, really, we lose ourselves in a really positive way in that, because through that we really connect more deeply in some kind of essential way with what's happening in life, as opposed to, you know, those negative states which separate us from life and from reality, even in a destructive way, because we're alienated and disconnected. You know, creativity, I'm delighted that you raised that, is another one of those things that, you know, people think so narrowly about creativity that, oh, well, if I paint pictures or something like that, that would be creative. When really, any activity done with an open heart and a true abandonment can be creative, I think, productive, and for the individual and for those around them, even transformative.
Yes. Now, I think some people, when they hear us talking like this, they'll feel like, wow, if I become open-hearted in your words or loving, I'm going to be so vulnerable, I'll get kicked to death in the new year. I won't have a great new year. I'll be kicked to death. I'll be so vulnerable. People will take advantage of me. But that's not my experience. Having been on both sides of this issue of how to live life, I used to live it when I was a young man from a very angry viewpoint. And I can tell you that when you come to life from an angry viewpoint, a reactive viewpoint, or a cynical viewpoint, one of the first and worst things that happens to you is those are the kinds of people that will gather around you. Mm-hmm. It won't be the loving people who will gather around you. It'll be the angry people who will gather around you. I even noticed that, Jerry, in my practice, when I was doing reform work, when I started in the early 70s, I'd go out and I'd give these really angry speeches. I was really angry. I was angry at the lobotomists. I was angry at the people who were mutilating the brains of little children. And I would give angry talks about it. And then when I would get calls from people who wanted to be my patient, they would be angry people. Then when I started to realize, I don't want to be angry all the time. I'm going to still do my reform work, but I'm not going to be engaging from anger. It's going to wear me out. So I would give more caring talks. Then the people who wanted to be my patients or wanted to be my friends, they were more loving people. And the other thing I noticed was that when I started to bring a more alertly loving, open-hearted approach to other human beings, I was actually much more aware of their negativity. I could spot more clearly somebody who really wasn't going to be nice to me or my friends or my wife or my kids, because it was in such contrast to the mood I was bringing. So don't be afraid that you'll be run over when you're a loving human being. It's almost more like a snow plow when you're loving, and what gathers around you is the white stuff, and the other folks sort of will, if anything, stay more out of your way, and you'll have a clearer perception of what's happening around you.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is, I think if you are really grounded in love, as you talked about, if you're really grounded in what I might use the language ground of being, the amazing thing is you can be open-hearted. You can abandon yourself in an open way to that situation which we find ourselves in from moment to moment. But in a funny sort of way, you are vulnerable, but you know, it doesn't hurt the same way because you are on bedrock. That ground of being is bedrock. Even though you're completely open, it's not vulnerable in the same way that you are when your footing is, you know, based on you know, the ego and identification with negative states and so on. So it's funny. There's a strength that comes with the right kind of vulnerability, with the right stance for that. Because that, it, in a funny sort of way, from that open-hearted position, the vulnerability that you experience is what enables you to be compassionate. It's what enables you to really be sensitive and responsive to that other person, because there's that deep and essential connection. We're plugged in together. And for therapists, I think that that's really, really important. I mean, it's important for everybody, but for therapists.
Yeah. I call that healing presence. In my book, The Heart of Being Helpful, the healing presence where you're centered on yourself as a source of caring and love and interest of another human being. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I'm so glad you put it the way you did. When you are centered on yourself in that manner, when you're determined that you're going to be there in a good way, within your power, my gosh, we're all so vulnerable, within your power, you're going to be there in a good way. When you feel that in your heart, then the insults that come along, the threats that come along, they're just not overwhelming, because they can't overwhelm the way you are with yourself and your ideals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's so important. I'm really glad you're stressing that. We have 2 minutes left, a little less. Jerry, a quick thought, and then I'll sum up. What would you like to say at the last here as New Year approaches?
Well, you know, again, just to stress that, you know, I think that people have much more power and influence and control over their lives than they realize, and that negative emotionality is what saps that in us. And it's so important to find some way to confront life in a more positive way. And I know that it can seem pretty challenging to folks, but I think, as you point out, one is start thinking about what it is in your experience, no matter how modest it might seem, that you can be grateful for. And another thing, I think, is ask yourself, what can you give? What can you contribute? What can you do to alleviate the burden, the difficulties, the challenges of the people around you? And you can start with your family and friends. That would be a great place. And every conversation that you enter into, what can I do to make this a more positive experience for this person?
Perfect.
What can I
Jerry,
get
that's
out of it?
A perfect. I've got to wrap up now. That's a wonderful way to end on being positive for that other person. And listen, Happy New Year. Coming Happy New Year. And on January 2nd, I'm going to have my second open mic. The first open mic was of great success. The first week of every month, it's open mic. You can call, we'll talk, we'll chat. So welcome to Open Mic on January 2nd.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.